on Broadway Radio. This week on Broadway, we review Spring Awakening. We also review Daddy Long Legs, Fondly Colette Richland, Otello, Turandot, and A Decade of Tennessee Williams in Provincetown. Please stay tuned. Welcome to Broadway Radio. It's this week on Broadway for Sunday, October 4th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Welcome back from Provincetown.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to talk about that in a little while, but first let's jump right into it because a highly anticipated opening has happened on Broadway, and all three of us have gotten a chance to see Spring Awakening. So, Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I'd love to. I adored the production. This is the Deaf West Theater production, the same company that did that really marvelous production of Big River some years ago. And I just, from the moment I heard that they were going to do this piece, I thought this could be really something special, because the as I'm sure many of our listeners know, the company is made up of largely of deaf actors, but also this production and Big River has hearing actors as well. And so basically what the situation is that some of the actors only sign their performances. Some of the actors speak and sign their performances simultaneously. And then in some cases, you have one actor signing the role while another one is speaking or singing it sort of in the background or standing next to them. And it can be extremely effective. In terms of Big River, that technique didn't necessarily have any bearing on the story, but it still worked beautifully. In this case, Spring Awakening is largely about the fact of lack of communication between the young people, the adolescents, and their parents, and also misunderstandings between the generations. And there's one character, Moritz, who is he's not doing well in school, and he's experiencing all these sexual feelings that he doesn't know how to deal with, and he's really struggling with adolescence, let's put it that way. So all of that technique that I mentioned, I thought really only added to the story of this really wonderful musical based on the play by Frank Wedekind, with music by Duncan Sheik and libretto and lyrics by Steven Sater. And I, as much as I loved the first production, I think I would say this one was even better. If anything, I believe I felt that there was some of Michael Mayer's direction of the original production that I did not like so much. And I think that that was the major flaw there. And in this case, this new production, this wonderful, beautiful new production, is directed by Michael Arden with choreography by Spencer Liff, I should say right off. And Michael Arden, I don't believe, has that much experience as a director. We know him primarily as a great actor and singer, but I would describe the direction as flawless. The way that the technique the techniques that I mentioned are used, and just the overall general direction, the blocking, and really, really wonderful. There were moments in the original production that I felt got laughs where there shouldn't have been. That did not happen in this production. There's one specific scene I know where there's a sort of a gay seduction of one young man for another, and it got some laughs in this case, but I felt only in the places where it was supposed to. Originally, it was not well acted, it was not well directed, and people were laughing inappropriately, I thought, and that really kind of ruined that scene. So I was really happy to see that scene played and directed so well in this case. The company is extraordinary. Many of them in their Broadway debuts, many of them, as I said, deaf to one extent or another. Also mixed with Cameron Mannheim, I think is one of the biggest names that we would recognize in it. Cameron Mannheim and Marley Matlin, of course, from Children of a Lesser God. And Patrick Page is in it, voicing the and acting many of the adult roles, but these young people, they're just really, really great. Sandra May Frank as Vendla, and it's a really big cast. Austin McKenzie as Melchior. Andy Mientis is in the show as Hanschen. And Moritz is this incredible young man named Daniel Durant. I just really loved it. I would urge everyone to see it. And as my theater companion said, there are some scenes that are done. There's one an incredible scene where Moritz, as I said, is really not doing well in school, and he's very, very, very upset about that, because as we learn, his father is very, very strict with him about that. And there's finally, they have a scene, a confrontation scene, and it's done completely in sign with no speech whatsoever. And it's unbelievably effective. So I've never seen anything. Well, I would say I've never seen anything like it, except that I did see Big River, but this is even more powerful and more, just as I said, the techniques working really to add to the story to an incredible degree. The one minor thing I would notice, and it took me a while to notice this, I'm wondering if you noticed it, Peter, and I'm sure they did this on purpose, but when people were actually speaking the lines, the sound was amplified in a way so that you didn't necessarily feel like their voices were coming from their mouths, directly from their mouths. And I think they did that because in many cases, one person is speaking for another, and they wanted it to seem consistent. So that was a little odd, but I adjusted to it, and I just really adored it. And I would hope to go see it at least once more.
All right, Peter, what do you think?
Yes, you know, it's pretty interesting to see this done essentially as a foreign film that's dubbed. In a strange way, that's what's going on here. And you have to admire everybody in the cast for being so astonishing at signing or learning the lines and having to coordinate what the mouth gestures are to what is being spoken. It's really quite an amazing thing. And you have to give credit to the hearing actors who've learned American Sign Language. They now know another language, which is really quite wonderful, too. That said, Michael and I don't agree on this one at all. I think one of the biggest problems of this show has been exacerbated by this production, and that is the fact, the opening line. The opening line of this show is "Mama Who Bore Me." Well, and the whole point of the first scene that we see after the song is that this girl has no idea where babies come from. So I don't know why she's singing "Mama Who Bore Me." But it's worse here because she uses American Sign Language, and the sign language is she actually does a gesture of a pregnant belly. She puts her hands under her breasts and then goes way out and comes back in right above her vagina to indicate a pregnant person. I have no problem with the fact that that is American Sign Language for bore me, but the thing is she's not supposed to know anything. So the lyric is, which was always terrible, is worse now. So I think that's an enormous problem that this production has not helped at all. I found the pace of it glacier-like, and I also found the direction was very confusing, that you didn't quite know where to look. You better know this show before you're going in. If you had seen the original production, you're going to have a nice head start on it, and you're going to be able to follow it. But I have a feeling that Spring Awakening Virgins, which is not an inappropriate term to use in this show, will have a tough time understanding what's going on because so much chaos is going on in the first act. I will admit the second act is clearer, that all the busyness in the direction, pyramids of people and all that kind of stuff, and a lot of artsy-fartsy moves are not there in the second act. So that helps amazingly, but I do think that it is but this is a Minority Report, by the way. Everybody tells me that Michael Arden's direction is brilliant. I didn't see that at all. All right. Well, anyway, but for the most part, yes, it is quite an experience. It's a unique theatrical experience. And for that reason alone, if you like Spring Awakening, you're going to find this quite an achievement and an astonishing variation on a theme. No question about that whatsoever. However, you know, again, if you don't know the show, I do a lot of homework. When the show came out some years ago, a new text of the original play came out, and the editor of that made a point of saying that, you know, gee, you know, this musical really isn't as good as this play, and I'm afraid that's really true. One of the things that I'll never forget is seeing the play at Juilliard in 1977.
Me too.
Did you?
With Boyd Gaines,
indeed. Yep. It's one of my, I'd say, 25 top theatrical experiences of all time. So as a result, I always had a hard time dealing with the musical, which I think dumbed it down quite a bit. One thing, too, I think the sound, especially when they sing, is terrible. But in a way, that's an asset because so many of Stephen Sater's lyrics don't rhyme at all. I counted 59 once. There may be more, there may be fewer. Maybe, you know, some things were meant to rhyme, you know, et cetera. But anyway, I think that's actually a liability under the circumstances. Duncan Sheik's music's very pleasant and very lovely in many spots. One thing I do like is that we don't rely on kids pulling out microphones out of their jackets. Now, Arthur Lawrence, who after all wrote West Side Story and Gypsy and, you know, has a far better reputation in the American theater than I do, said that was one of the most brilliant things he ever saw in his life. I hated it. I don't like anachronisms of any kind. I mean, if we were watching Camelot and Lancelot came out in a Nehru jacket, they would say, that's wrong. You know, well, why are microphones okay? You know, I mean, they didn't have microphones in 1891. And I understand German expressionism. And I understand symbolism. I understand taking liberties. I understand all that, and I don't like it. So, anyway, there are microphones used in the show, but not in the way that they were used originally. So for me, that's a step forward. And I guess, you know, I haven't yet made my peace with Spring Awakening, the musical, I suspect I never will. But the achievement level of what's going on up there is astonishing beyond belief. And that's one of the reasons why I'm glad I came.
Well, that's interesting what you said about the microphones. I always thought that I never had a problem with that in the original production because the whole point of this is that the whole show is an anachronism. And I think it's interesting that the dialogue, I would say, is 100% could be performed in period. It's only when they start singing that it's suddenly like becomes the modern counterpart of these people. So that I didn't have a problem with that with the mics initially. And in this production, did you notice they have the costuming for the actual characters playing the actual playing the actual characters in period was really quite, I would say, historically accurate. Whereas the other people, like the voices, the in the case of Moritz, for example, the modern voice, they were dressed in modern dress, and so was the band, which is on stage. So I thought that was a really good solution to that. I agree with you about some of the pacing, Peter, especially at the beginning. I don't agree about the focus, but I do agree about the pacing. And I have to say, I have to hand it to you. You're absolutely right about Mama Who Bore Me. It just really never actually occurred to me. I mean, what can Mama Who Bore Me mean other than that she knows how she was born?
Yeah,
because right after that, she asked the question.
Right after.
And the mother says, the stork.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, you're right. I mean, I have always recognized from the beginning that there are some really, really big howlers and errors in the lyrics. Whereas the music, as you say, I agree with you, is I think it's really pretty uniformly wonderful. I wish they had taken another pass at the lyrics. But they didn't. So,
well, to be fair, I do believe this was Stephen Sage's project, and he's the one who went to Duncan Sheik and said, "I could be wrong about this, but I think that's what I remember hearing."
Oh, yeah.
Saying, "Hey, I've got this idea for a musical." So, I mean, he's the power behind the piece, and I just wish that he were more interested in a rhyming dictionary. But again, you're not going to notice it here. Believe me, it's hard to understand those lyrics. It really is. And
but it's also it's not just rhymes, as you said.
No,
certainly is one problem. But then there are the phrases that don't really make any sense.
It's going to be interesting, too, to see what kind of business this show does. For all the awards, for all the acclaim, for all the rave reviews, the original production sold out, I think, like 3 of the 100-odd weeks it was here. And there were plenty of empty seats the night I went, and I understand TDF has it all the time. So it does seem that this is something that is not going to be a hot ticket. And it may very well be, because in so many ways, it's a very hard-hitting show. It's almost hard-hitting relentlessly.
Yeah.
And under those circumstances, people who have suffered enough at their jobs during the day want to have a better time of it at night. So they may very well have trouble selling tickets. Mm-hmm. I'm not predicting we'll close early, but I do think the idea of a limited engagement was always a good idea.
I think they actually – didn't they extend a little bit already?
Yeah, they
sounds
did.
Right to me.
Yeah.
But it'll be really, really engrossing to see the grosses and see if indeed this does do the type of business that, of course, they're hoping it's going to do, and commensurate with the response that it's got from so many. It certainly has received money reviews. See if the money comes in.
Just briefly, I would like to say I know many people feel that the play, the musical has been, whatever word you want to use, dumbed down or smoothed over. I have never had a problem with that. There are two major things in it, I think. In the original play, the sex scene between Melchior and Wendla is much more clearly a rape. But I think I completely understand why they changed that, and I don't think that it really I don't have a problem with it, because I don't think that's the main point. The main point is that these people don't have the information, and they don't know what's going to happen. And one can understand why they would be afraid that modern audiences would just completely lose sympathy for Melchior if he violently raped her. And then the other big change is that in the end of the play, there's a sort of expressionistic character of this man who shows up and kind of leads Melchior. Melchior is in the graveyard and he's thinking of killing himself, and Moritz appears holding his head in his hands. Moritz is already dead, and Moritz is trying to basically talk Melchior into killing himself to join him in death because he's his best friend. But then this what is it? I'm sorry, I can't remember. Is it the masked man? The
I don't know.
The mysterious man, something like that. That's into the woods.
Yeah,
anyway,
yeah.
this sort of symbolic figure representing adulthood, I guess, comes in and talks Melchior into not killing himself and following him out of the graveyard. It's very, very effective in the play. And that last scene between Moritz and Melchior is absolutely heartbreaking. But I can see why they thought that kind of device would not work in the musical. So I like both versions, except I really do wish the lyrics were better. I really do. And because I think that other than that, I think it's really a beautiful piece.
Boy, you know, I often ask people, if there were a time machine, what would you go back and see? I'd like to go back to 1906 and see when this play first got its first production, because the play really does have something to say, which is, parents, if you don't level with your kids, the consequences will come out later. And but if I saw it in 1906, I might have known what it was if I had been friendly with Franck, because indeed it took 15 years for this play to be produced. He wrote it in 1891. 1906 was its first production. And I'm not surprised at all. This must have been not just hot stuff, but I mean, you know, the sun level of temperature hot stuff back in 1891, because this play told the truth. And as we know, a lot of people don't want to hear the truth.
Well, I'll go one better. When I saw that 1977 production, I was still in high school. And actually a teacher brought me, because I think he thought I would benefit from it.
Gotcha.
You know, in several ways. And I could not believe when he told me when it was written.
Yeah.
I mean, I almost literally could not believe it.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. Sure, sure. Yeah.
So let me jump in here and bring up a few things I want your opinions on. Did you guys notice, Peter, you were sitting right behind me at the at the performance we were at, and the audience was packed full of people who were signing before in an intermission. Yes. Mm-hmm. That was very interesting to me, because I had never seen that before in a Broadway house. So many deaf people engaging in Broadway, which I thought was very interesting. And obviously this is directed towards an audience like that. So I thought that was very interesting.
It made a big impression on my girlfriend, too, whose parents were deaf. Both of Linda's parents were deaf. So as a result, she was so gratified to see that. And she was telling me what some of the people were saying.
Eavesdropping from afar.
Right.
Oh, and I started to say, but I didn't finish. The person that I went with remarked about how incredibly loud the silence And we also failed to mention, in addition to the techniques that I did mention, sometimes they communicate to the audience by like surtitles, I guess you would call on various parts of the stage. So I thought all of that was just that aspect of it was beautifully and seamlessly done. And I
it was. I also noticed before the show and throughout the show, it sounded like there was an intentional white noise coming through the sound system.
I'm not sure that was intentional. I thought it was the loudest goddamn air conditioning I have ever heard.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, I thought so too, Peter, but I was thinking it was an intentional white noise.
Well, it reminds me of that production of Cyrano de Bergerac, where one critic said, "Oh, I just love the lighting, the red behind. It made such a nice effect." And actually, there were exit signs leading through. So you can give the benefit of the doubt, James, and maybe you're a nicer person than I. But I'll tell you, that was a loud air conditioning system.
Oh, so, that's interesting. And because there's no Tony Award for sound, so we can't. We'll never find that out.
No. But I don't. I mean, for what it's worth, I don't think it was really that loud, Peter. It's just that you would hear total silence in the theater. You could hear aside from the air conditioning, you could hear a pin drop when in those scenes where there was no music. No talking, just signing. really, really incredibly effective.
I don't believe it. I think the air conditioning system is too loud. I don't believe it has anything. I understand what you're saying. Of course, there are plenty of times when, yes, you could film a Sprint commercial in the theater. I understand that. But that air conditioning has to be fixed.
Well, where were you guys sitting?
We were fourth row in the orchestra on the right.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a little further back. Maybe it got lower as you went back. I don't know.
And you were talking before about this being a longtime project. The woman who played Wendela, she has done this role a number of times. So I wonder if this it definitely predated Deaf West. And so I wonder who had the original concept here, and maybe it has played a bunch of places before, or maybe there was somebody else, or it could be that it was.
Well, I knew Deaf West did it in L.A. I'm a little surprised to hear if there was. It was predated that, but maybe in a school, maybe it was school situations, perhaps.
So, Sandra May Frank, who plays Wendela, she on her website, she put in her bio section, her next stage film, she's playing Spring Awakening again as Wendela at the Wallace Annenberg Center for the Performing Arts in Beverly Hills from May 21st to June 14th. Obviously, this was before Deaf West. You know, this was the Deaf West production. So she wrote this before Deaf West that she is playing it. It seemed like she had done it twice before that, according to her credits. So that I thought that was very interesting.
Because of her parent youth, I would think that maybe it was school situations, but who knows?
Yeah.
I'd like to know how much rehearsal they had. if this was the standard rehearsal period, this is even a greater achievement. I mean, when Jerome Robbins' Broadway was done, he insisted on 8 weeks of rehearsal rather than the standard four that most shows get. And if this one got four, this is really even a greater, greater achievement than I experienced. So, credit where it's due. I mean, yeah, I have issues with the show. I always have. I always will. But wow, what an amazing thing to witness.
Something that bothered me about the show was that, and I'm not sure if this was lighting or direction or what happened there, but, you know, when you had the actor who was signing and the actor who was singing, at some points in the show, they put them at diametrically opposite corners where, you know, Patrick Page would be in a booth in the house on the balcony.
Yeah.
And then the action is happening in the, upper left-hand corner of the stage. And I could sort of understand that. But then at times you would have the actor who was signing and you could not find the person who was singing because they weren't lit.
Right.
They weren't near the person. And that kind of annoyed me.
And they weren't consistent with that.
And they weren't consistent. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, at different times, I thought it was really, I love the opening scene where they handed the guitar through the mirror and the nightgown.
Yes.
But that was a great concept, and then they never did anything with it again. As Michael mentioned, the projections were, I loved the projections.
Yeah, me too. But I'm with you, James, about that, which is another way of saying that I think there's a problem with focus in the show.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah. I didn't know if you had noticed this as well, that there wasn't the necessary monitor hanging on the in the first tier of the conductor. The actors couldn't see the conductor. The band is on stage and in back of the actors, and it was just interesting to me that there was no television monitor with the conductor on it.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Page is a gift to the theater. Amazing. Amazing that he can sort of print so many different characters in such a short period of time, and his voice is just amazing.
Carrie and others have talked about,
and my wife was swooning over the voice, and my wife hated the show, hated it And she was like,
had she seen it before?
No, she had not seen it before.
Yeah.
Had not seen it before. Sure. And I was right in the middle of it. Somebody had asked me the next day if I could recommend it. And I was like, I think it's right on the border of recommendation, not recommendation. I think I directed them to the Spring Awakening website to watch some of the videos to see if they enjoyed the feel of
sure,
it
sure
before yeah because I said I don't know if I can recommend this across the board the way that I I've you know recommended Hamilton or something rotten
Well,
obviously, as Peter mentioned, even the original production, for all its acclaim of a, you know, it didn't run that long and it only sold out what, 2 or 3 weeks, you know, it is not for everybody for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just the subject matter alone, the way it's handled, you know, aside from our opinions are of the lyrics and the other flaws.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So last week, Carrie Purcell reviewed this because she had seen it before Peter and I saw it. And I asked the question, I'll ask it of you two. Was it necessary to have Cameron and Marley in this production?
Yeah, I understand the idea of having a hearing adult and a signing adult for both characters. And
James means celebrity. Marquee value, yeah.
You know, celebrity, you know, absolutely, those characters are absolutely necessary. I think it's great. But was it necessary to bring in name actors to, you know, potentially draw box office? Was it really necessary?
I don't know how many people are going or where they're even in it. You know, it's not like they get billing over the title. I don't know if they've been doing interviews or anything like that. I do want to say, and this is a tangent, I do want to say that Cameron Manheim is quite the Harridan in this show. Boy, she could play Badia tomorrow, considering what she's doing in this show. This is one tough cookie for a mother, you know. So I know that's not the question you're asking. But anyway, yeah. I don't think that this so-called star power, and yes, I do know people know who both of them are, and perhaps even Cameron Manheim more than Marley Matlin, who after all is famous for one movie. I do believe that this is really an ensemble show and people are going to come in and say, oh, isn't that lady who used to be on? You know, I think that's what's going to happen. More than, wow, let's go see the Cameron Manheim show.
I also think that those two and also Russell Harvard are in it mostly because it is a pro deaf production and they more than the actual thought of, oh, these people are going, their names are going to sell tickets. And especially in the case of Marley and Russell actually don't have that much to do.
Right.
Cameron has more to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my thought. It's more like a political, you know what I mean? Political is the right word.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Just wanting to be part of another Broadway production by the Deaf West Theater Company.
Sure.
No, and I get that. You know, the question is from a producerial standpoint, could we have swapped them out and paid the other actors less money and would this production have suffered if two name actors, which are being highly featured on the website, highly featured in the print ads, and in every single press release we get from the press reps about this, it's all about, you know, making sure that we know Marley Matlin and Cameron Manheim are in it, are in the show, but, you know, they have very small roles.
I would not be terribly surprised if I heard that they had some kind of favored nations set up and that those people were not getting star salaries. I could be completely wrong.
All right. So the last question I'm going to ask is, what the hell was that forest at the end?
Oh, I think that means happier times.
But it was just so...
Well, I think it's the
happier time. Michael, what were you going to say? I'm sorry.
I think more specifically, it's the children moving on, like from childhood to adult.
Yeah, I understand that, but I thought it was poorly executed, and it was so. They had shown so many great visuals throughout the whole show. I thought that was not on par with the rest of the show.
I think it might have been more effective if they sent the kids out through the house at that point.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
Say what you will, Whatever anybody feels about Spring Awakening, here we are, 43 minutes later, still talking about it. It is a show that does demand our attention, and we've certainly given it to it this morning.
Okay, the three of us, we're going to move on. Excuse me, I'm sorry. The three
Not
of us,
at all. That wasn't a complaint. I mean, it's an observation.
Absolutely.
There's a lot to talk about, and that is an inherent strength of Spring Awakening.
Yes.
Absolutely, and Michael's point about it having been written in the late 1800s, it's amazing because it feels like it was just written in the last 15 years.
Yeah, I agree, and so, I have a feeling that will always be true. Anyway,
the three of us got a chance to head over to the Davenport Theater where we saw Daddy Long Legs, which is it trying to be She Loves Me? Is it trying to be the Fantastics? I will ask Peter Felicia first. What do you think?
it's a very nice, sweet show. No question about that. A young woman who has an intelligence about her gets the attention of a benefactor. I'm not going to tell you why, but he decides that he is going to be her sponsor. He will pay for her education because he feels she deserves it, that she has great ability and he has great expectations for her. The one thing he does insist is that she doesn't expect him to write back. He wants to hear from her, but do not expect anything from me. It's not going to happen. She calls him Daddy Longlegs because there's an analogy with a spider she saw. I mean, I think the title's terrible. It always has been. I've never liked it. There's been so many incarnations of this. It does take a long time to tell this story. I was convinced that this was going to be 90 minutes and out, and my heart sank when I looked and saw that there was a second act. Music and lyrics by Paul Gordon. Some of them are quite nice. And there are three songs that I think are really terrific. One especially called The Secret of Happiness. And No Fools They. They reprise each one of the three songs that I like the best. So they have the opinion that these songs are their strongest suit, too. Music is quite lovely and quite right for the period, which is more than we can say for another show, but that's another story. And for me, the real problem had much to do with the actress who is playing the Jerusha Abbott, the girl who is the beneficiary. Her name is Megan McGinnis, and I don't blame her, but I do blame John Kerr, the director, because I'm sure she's giving him what he wants. And the thing is, this is an actress who does not have 36 expressions, sweet as pie, as tough as leather. She has one expression, which is sweet as pie, and she uses it incessantly, and the look on her face is almost the same throughout the entire show. Lovely is the one thing she can do, and that's it. You know? And I think that's a real problem, because occasionally in the second act, she gets angry a little, you know, but most of the time, she's just sunny and adorable, and she does bear out the assumption that she's a really bright girl and she's going to be a hell of a writer sometime. At the end of the show, she sends him a check for $1,000 because she's having a story published. Wow. In 1906? God, I wish I could get that money now.
I know.
Good Lord. It's an acceptable, for me it was an afternoon. It's an acceptable afternoon or evening. It's certainly intelligent. It doesn't rub anybody the wrong way, I'm sure. But is it mandatory theater going? I'm afraid not.
I went into the piece completely cold. There is a film loosely based, I guess, on the original book with Fred Astaire and Leslie Caron, but I've never seen it. So I went in cold. And, it struck me as kind of a combination of My Fair Lady, Gigi, and She Loves Me.
Mm-hmm.
Little kind of elements of all three of those. although, as Peter mentioned, she, the girl Jerusha, is not supposed to expect any letters from "quote unquote" Daddy Long Legs, but he does sort of communicate with her through his secretary, supposedly. Although it's actually him writing the letters. I one thing that was a relief to me was that the creep factor was really basically not there. I was afraid a little bit of the older man, very young woman thing, but in this version anyway, it's made clear that the man, first of all, he's not that old. I don't know. Would you say he's supposed to be in his 30s?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Though, of course, she assumes he's substantially older, and that concept is milked tremendously in the show. But, Michael, good point. Never even occurred to me the creep factor. So they're really doing their job well there.
Yeah, and like they make the point that that this fellow Jervis has done this before, and that he's in the past he's sponsored male students, but then he even like he makes some remark about that, and he says he'd like to to sponsor a girl this time because he wasn't necessarily that happy with the way that it went when he sponsored the male. So he's not in it. You know, his original intention is not supposed to have anything to do with forming a relationship with the girl. It just, that's something that happens over a period of years. And, you know, it takes him a while to even meet, because he finally does meet her in his actual name. But of course she doesn't know that that's Daddy Long Legs and blah, 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 blah. I agree with you about the title too, Peter. It's really pretty bad. Mm. And aside from everything else, that daddy, you know, connotes sugar daddy. Mm. So maybe that wasn't even a thought in those days, but to us it does. I'm going to have to disagree with you about the music being period. I mean, maybe more so than Spring Awakening, but I thought it all sounded like very contemporary popish. Although I liked the score, other than that, I think people like me who have a problem with that, and people, and apparently Peter does too. There was the one song I noted, but this is just one example. Jervis has a big ballad in Act Two called Charity, and it's like a country waltz.
Yes, that's true. Yes, you're right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was yeah. I mean, that one really stood out at me. But the others, I mean, they're not.
By the way, that got one of the biggest hands at my performance. By the way, people love that song. That really was a showstopper. But yeah, I felt that was wrong. I know what you mean by the contemporary feel to it. I find the touches, the contemporary touches, more embellishment on what sounds to me like period music. So okay. Anyway,
and obviously there's no glaring anachronisms like electric guitars or anything like that. Mm-hmm. It's just a little orchestra. There's a, let's see. Well, there are guitars, but they're acoustic, and there's a cello and a keyboard.
Cellos.
Yeah, and I counted, by the way. I think it could have been a one act. There were 24 songs, including reprises. That's quite a lot for this kind of a story. I think they could have telescoped it, and it would be stronger if they did so. That said, and aside from my problems with the period, non-period sound of the score to my ears, I thought it was quite a good score, and the lyrics were really quite good, although sometimes maybe a little too repetitious. This is the fellow who wrote Jane Eyre. I'm gonna have to go back and listen to that again and see if my feelings on that score have changed, because I thought there was a lot of good work here. I really did.
So I was watching it, and I just kept on thinking they were going to break into Ice Cream.
Yeah, well, as I said, yeah, that's funny. But really, there's a lot of Gigi.
Yeah,
there's a lot of My Fair Lady and quite a bit of She Loves Me, I think.
Yeah, and my wife loved the show.
Oh,
and countered me with, well, this was written before then, and I was like, I don't know. I have really? To go check. I have to go check. So I was just, rather than, you know, getting in front of Wikipedia, I'll ask the human Wikipedia, Peter Felicia, what's the ruling on this?
Are you talking about the actual property of Daddy Long Legs being in existence before the actual property?
The material that it's based on.
Yeah. Based on. I believe Daddy Long Legs dates back to the 19th century.
Yet again, my unbroken streak of being wrong to my wife.
Oh, that's worth looking into, but I'm that's what I remember hearing.
I believe so, because the story, I think that's right. And I think that's in the notes somewhere, although we may not be.
No, 1912.
All right, 1912. All right. And so when was the original version of Parfumerie, right? When was that?
I would think it was that.
Yeah, I think it was the 20s or 30s, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was interesting and good. I agree with you, and my wife agreed with you, that it was two or three songs too long. It would have been great for a 90 minutes in and out. Oh, Peter, I love those 90 minutes in and out. You know, leave us wanting more. Leave us wanting more. Don't give us everything.
Parfumerie is 1937.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Look at all these shows that are, you know, brilliant from that era that we're getting that the basis of the stories from that. So, the 45th Street Theater, the new now renamed Davenport Theater. So it's a beautiful little space, and that
it's certainly been improved. When Primary Stages was there, it seemed like no matter what seat I was sitting in was wrecked beyond compare. And I don't seem to be sitting in seats like that anymore. So, so I think maybe there have been improvements there.
Oh yeah, they did a major rehaul before that. Around the World in 80 Days opened.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from an audience standpoint, it is quite wonderful, except for maybe the first couple of rows are a little too close to the stage and a little too low.
I've sat there. Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
But it is apparently quite a challenge for producers and actors and directors, because there are, as I understand it, no wings.
Oh yeah.
Like, basically nothing. I think there's a space in the back, but not on the sides, if I understand correctly. And if you notice, the orchestra was above.
Yeah.
Above and behind the set, because I think that's literally the only place they could put them.
Is there going to be a cast recording of this production, do you think?
I would think so.
They've recorded a number of songs that are up on their website. I don't know if they did that for promo or if they're actually going to release it. Was there a cast recording of Dr. Zhivago? I don't recall.
One's coming? Yeah,
because
definitely recorded.
My wife loved Paul Alexander Nolan. I liked him too. He was
I
remember
in this show.
Yeah. When I saw him in Zhivago, I really thought he was great. He was one of the standouts in Zhivago. And so it was great to see him again in such a small, intimate setting. And
he has a wonderful
voice. He's got a great voice.
He really does.
He really needs a big show to get him out there.
Do you remember how incredible he sounded in Jesus Christ Superstar?
Yeah. Oh, just
yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. There is an album that I have here. I don't know if it was commercially released. There's nothing about it that seems to indicate. There is one of those price codes, those lines, whatever it's called. And this Megan McGinnis is in it, but a guy named Robert Adelman Hancock is playing the other part. So I really don't know what this recording is. It says Rubicon Theater Company, Cincinnati, Playhouse in the Park, Theater Works, David Elser and Michael Jackowitz present a world premiere musical. So I don't know if this was sold at any of these places or what. I don't know how I got it. But so at least they've recorded that one.
Well, I just answered my own question because I was looking for Paul Alexander Nolan on the internet and on Twitter. He's got a tweet here that says, day two recording of Long Legs musical album. It's nice to have use of a palm full of hair cement.
Well, with John Caird behind
Sure.
Good point.
That's true.
Yeah.
And it was interesting that on the Daddy Long Legs musical website for the Off-Broadway production, they have a list of all the productions around the world that are have come and also are coming and are existing right now. So that's interesting as well. But I, you know, I could recommend this absolutely to folks. I thought it was very good, even if it was three ballads too long.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, Peter, mm-hmm. last week we talked about Fondly Colette with Carrie, and you got a chance to see it. So tell us, what'd you think about it?
Well, yes, the show Fondly Colette Richland is the name of it. And Carrie made a point of saying, I have no idea what was going on. Yeah, and I have a feeling that what's going on here, this is a production of the Elevator Repair Service. And I think it's time that we might consider that the Elevator Repair Service, well, let me put it this way. Every year, there's a Costco in New Jersey that decides to put on a show, which they call the Costco Follies, and everybody has a good time. I apparently understand. I've never been. Maybe this is really a company that repairs elevators, and they decided to do a show once a year too, because really, it seems very strange and very amateurish. You've heard of kitchen sink dramas like The Subject Was Roses, which takes place mostly, if not all, in a kitchen. This is a kitchen sink drama too, in a way that they throw everything but the kitchen sink in it. I mean, it is really inscrutable and the type of thing you call a phantasmagoria, which is a euphemism for a messy show. And there are some interesting lines in it. You know, Jesus Christ doesn't interfere in our lives, not as much as Satan does. That is an interesting idea. The Satan's always around, but Jesus Christ doesn't seem to be around nearly as much. That I guess that's in the eye of the beholder, I'll grant you. How we hold on to all illusions and call them distant memories. I like that line too. The line that got the best response, there's a shill in the audience who yells at the stage, and he's escorted out of the theater, and his last line is, I won't be renewing my subscription. Well, that got a big laugh because most people were feeling much the same thing. This may set the record for the most walkouts I've ever seen because, and you have to understand that New York Theater Works is not a theater that's divided into left, center, and right. They are long, 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 long rows. And row, maybe E, was almost completely empty after the intermission. I would say maybe there are 25 seats in that row. I would say that maybe six people were left after the intermission. And believe me, it wasn't the only row to suffer attrition. There were one, two, three, four, five, at least six in my row that I noticed. And and again, I didn't really pay attention to the expanse far beyond, but right around me there were six empties. And I had a clearer view of the stage in the second act because the people in front of me left too. And yet, there was a guy off to the side in front of me who was having a hell of a time and laughed at everything and just enjoyed it immensely. I don't know if he wrote it. No, he didn't, because it's written by a woman named Sybil Kempson. But I'm afraid I have to reiterate what Carrie said. I don't know what this all meant. I thought it was going to be an indictment of suburban life, because it starts out with a husband and wife. You know, the guy comes home from work. She's made the dinner. She's really worked hard on the dinner, and he says it's delicious and all that kind of stuff. Where it goes from there is just bizarre beyond belief, and I can't even begin to tell you anything about it that's cogent, because it wasn't cogent to me.
So you were not Fondly Colette Richland.
No,
I've been waiting 2 weeks to say that. All right, so let's move forward. Michael was at the Met and saw Otello in Turandot.
Yes.
Dot. Durandot. Just to let you in on the joke there, is that before the show we were doing pre-production, I said Turandot, and I was corrected, as this is not French.
No.
It's just not. So, Michael, tell us about your productions.
Well, Otello is a new production that opened the Met season. I did not see it on opening night. I saw it about a week later. And the salient point here is that it's directed by Bartlett Shearer, who I'm told that's how you pronounce it. Shearer, not Scherer.
Oh, yeah?
Is that what we all understand?
No idea.
Yeah. Yeah, oh. That's what I've heard.
Okay. Well, anyway, and I'm afraid that I was quite disappointed in the direction.
Sheer madness. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've said before, I think that Mr. Shearer's theater productions are far, far superior to his operas, the ones that I've seen. This is the third that I've seen at the Met. He's done a few more. I just don't think he has a feel for it. And as someone pointed out, after I saw Otello, I then read a review in the Times, which was much more positive than I would have given it. But he made the point that rehearsal periods in opera, to go back to that subject, tend to be much shorter than for Broadway and other theater situations. So I think that was a lot of it. There were moments where there were some really good ideas and really committed performances, but there was a lot of just very basic, dull blocking. And one of the most disappointing things is the staging of the chorus was so incredibly static and boring. I couldn't quite believe it. The opera opens, the opera of Otello by Verdi cuts out the whole several first, I believe what's considered the first act or more of the play, and it starts actually in Cyprus. So in the middle of a huge, tremendous storm at sea, and Othello's boat, a ship is coming in, but the populace is gathered, on the quay or whatever, and they're looking out to sea, and they see that the ship is in great trouble, and they're not sure if it's going to sink. So there's the music is tremendous, and the chorus is singing their guts out, praying for the ship to come in, and there's supposed to be chaos with people running around and trying to. The chorus was basically just standing there with blank expressions on their face, and I thought, well, I don't know if that would normally even be the province of Bartlett Shearer to stage the chorus, but whoever was supposed to do it did an incredibly bad job. Then after Othello arrives, his ship comes in safe, and he tells them that he's won the battle, and then he goes off, and then there's a scene of rejoicing around a bonfire with people dancing and drinking and everyone having people. There was none of that. There was no fire. People were just kind of milling around. They didn't seem the looks on their faces didn't seem any different from when they were looking out at sea and praying for the ship to come in. I really could not believe that. So that's how those are the first two scenes I've just described. So it got off to a really bad start, and it didn't get much better than that. And on top of that, this is one of those weird cases where I thought that the tenor, Alexander's Antonienko, I thought he just sounded awful. He has a huge voice, but I thought it sounded constricted and very wobbly. And that kind of thing, you would not think that would be a matter of opinion. I mean, you would think whether a voice has a wobble and whether it sounds constricted is sort of more a factual statement, but I seem to be in the minority on that, so I don't know what to tell you. The rest of the cast was quite wonderful, specifically Desdemona, or Desdemona, as it's pronounced in Italian, Sonia Yoncheva. But I
the last two productions of Othello at the Met, that I've seen, the first one that I saw there was when they were still doing a Zeffirelli production years ago. And then the that was really great. And then the one since then, there was another one that was even better, I would say. But now I think they've taken a step back, and that's too bad. But two nights later, I got to see, speaking of Zeffirelli, they're still doing his incredibly beautiful production of Turandot, with costumes by Anna Ani and Dada Salieri, lighting designed by Gil Wexler, choreographer, and here I think is the person that needs the amazing credit here, Chang Ching. The choreography of the chorus and the staging of the chorus in Turandot is absolutely thrilling. Aside from the magnificent sets and the just the whole production that Zeffirelli put together, gosh, this production dates back several decades, and I hope they keep it. I hope they don't junk it. I just hope they keep doing it. Christine Gerke as Turandot, and Marcelo Alvarez as Calaf, the main tenor, and Hibla Gersmava as Liu, the second soprano, were all magnificent. Also Dwayne Croft as Ping, and James Morris, the great basso, is still singing beautifully as Timur. So that was one of the great nights that I've had recently. I'm almost surprised they're still doing this production. When you see it and you see the amount of people on stage, there are dance doubles for three of the roles. There are extras in addition to the entire ballet company. I guess they don't really have a specific ballet company at the Met anymore. They job people in now for operas where they need dancing. But it's a huge cast, tremendous orchestra, unbelievably gorgeous sets, and one of the most beautiful operas ever written. So if there's anything you can see at the Met this season, I even though this is not a new production, I would put it at the absolute top of my list.
Wow, that's great. As we've discussed before, the Metropolitan Opera has a vast, wide range of inexpensive to very expensive tickets. If you would like to purchase the very expensive ones, go right ahead. But they do have many inexpensive options to check out as well. I'll link to those things on the show page, and so you can check the Metropolitan Opera out.
And you should, of course, you should see these live if you can. But they also do their cinecasts all over the country at really – you know, very reasonable prices. So that's an option for people who are not in the New York area.
All right. Also, Michael was away last week at the Tennessee Williams Festival.
Yes.
And they very, very cleverly called it Year 10. Year 10 at P-Town, a decade of Tennessee Williams in Provincetown, with their website full of shirtless boys. Okay. So, Michael, tell us about the shirtless boys.
Well, they figured in at least two of the things that I saw. this is the 10th year of the festival. I've gone for the past several years, and it's really quite extraordinary. They, as I've said before, there is only one actual dedicated theater in Provincetown nowadays, which is actually in a converted garage. And it would be the equivalent of a nice, intimate off-Broadway theater here in New York. I would say it only seats, I'm going to guess, 199 maybe. But they don't have anything like a larger, you know, state-of-the-art theater, which is really kind of sad because it is considered the birthplace of the modern American theater. Maybe someday they will get the funding together to have something like that. That would be wonderful. But so they do use the theater that I mentioned that they have. They use that for some of their productions, but a lot of them, because they have so few options, they do some of them in the auditorium of what used to be the high school and is now the grammar school. But that actually is one of the worst venues because it's got fixed seats, you know, but it looks like a
convert. It used to be maybe a gym auditorium, but now it's just an auditorium with fixed seats, but no rake whatsoever. So the sidelines are awful. There was also no air in the theater for the show that I saw there, and it's just not.
You should borrow it from the Brooks Atkinson, which has excellent air conditioning.
See, it all comes together, doesn't it, Peter? But they also do. They make lemonade out of lemons. Is that the expression?
Yes.
Yeah. They make lemonade out of lemons by using alternative venues. Like there was one show I saw that was done on the porch of a hotel. And then we followed the actors inside, and then the rest of it took place inside the hotel. But then they also do a lot of outdoor productions when they can. And the two highlights of this were – it was really quite extraordinary. There was a piece called Road to Paradise, a dance theater piece performed by a company from Bennington College. And it was based on poems and other writings that Williams did while in Provincetown, telling the true story of his affair with a male dancer named Kip. And the main characters in that were Tennessee, Tom himself, Kip, and a young woman who is Kip's quote-unquote girlfriend, even though he's having wild sex with Tom. And she convinces him that he has to stop doing that because he's being turned into a homosexual. So this was apparently a very, very, very formative experience in Tennessee Williams' life. He had a very intense relationship with this Kip fellow, and then it ended for that reason. And then Kip died not that long after. So you can imagine that would be the kind of beautiful traumatic experience that would really inform a writer, and indeed it did. So this company did a really wonderful dance theater production of these writings on the deck of the Boat Slip, which is a very large bar disco right on the bay in Provincetown. And then another production in the festival was a show called The Parade, which is a short play that Williams wrote early on based on this exact same story. With those three characters that I just mentioned, plus one or two more. And in the play, Tom, Tennessee, is called Don, and Kip is called Dick, and the woman is called, either Miriam or Wanda. I'm not sure which of the two it was. But it was really kind of amazing to see the true story and then the fictional version of it within 2 days and within a few blocks of each other, and both done outdoors. The parade was done on the beach where it's supposed to take place. And both within like four blocks of the actual place where Tennessee Williams met Kip, a place called Captain Jack's Wharf, which still exists. So those were the incredible highlights of this festival for me. There was on the negative side that one of the things I was most looking forward to and got the most pre-publicity was a production of Suddenly Last Summer by a company from Columbus, Mississippi. And that was in the very unfortunate venue that I just mentioned previously, the high school / grammar school auditorium. So that was a big strike against them, but also it was the only show I've seen in about 5 years of the festival where the acting and the directing were just really, really inadequate. So that was really a disappointment. I'm not sure if those involved had actually seen this production before they imported it, or maybe they had just heard its reputation and for some reason maybe it had gotten good reviews, and I don't know. But or maybe it was political. Maybe they were there for political reasons. But that was a tremendous disappointment. But, you know, there were like eight other things to see. there was an evening in Town Hall, which is a much better venue, of readings from How is this? How incredible is this? The festival has presented 11 world premiere productions of plays written by Williams during its 10 years. Now, some of them are very short. Some of them aren't. But I think that's extraordinary. And they did readings from all of those with a cast including Keir DeLay, his wife Maya Dillon, Lou Liberatore. These are the three names that I think people would recognize. Also, Jeremy Lawrence, who's done a lot in New York, and a wonderful local actor who also starred in The Parade, Ben Berry, and many other. It was quite a large cast. So that was another highlight, and that was a wonderful thing for someone to see who had never been to the festival before, to get an idea of the scope of it over 10 years and really the aside from the many revivals they've done, just the world premieres. I think that's a really kind of amazing feat.
All right. So we're going to have to gear up for that again next year. I guess this is going to be 11th?
As far as I know, yeah.
And I see on their on the website of the Provincetown Tennessee Williams website, they are mission to Cuba February 10th through the 17th in 2016. So obviously that they are gearing up for more stuff in 2016. I'll have links to that stuff in on the webpage for BroadwayRadio.com. And I think we should probably wrap it up for the day. Before we talk about trivia, I want to remind people that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and get us streamed directly to you. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found at BroadwayRadio.com as well. So, Peter, tell us about last week's trivia answer.
Yeah, last week I asked Carol Channing, Angela Lansbury, and Virginia Capers all won Tonys as Best Actress in a Musical. But there's another interesting commonality among them, and what is it? And my point was the Carol Channing won for Hello, Dolly, which was a musical version of The Matchmaker. Angela Lansbury won for Mame, which was a musical version of Auntie Mame. Virginia Capers won for Raisin, which was a musical version of A Raisin in the Sun. And when these plays were first produced, the plays now, not the musicals, the actresses playing Dolly Levi, Auntie Mame, and Mama all received Tony nominations but did not win the award. So it took a musical version of each of these plays to get the actress in this role to get a Tony Award. So that's the answer to that one. Now, this week I'm going to do something a little different, and that is the fact that in my Critzer Lang column, I asked a question. I do a brain teaser every month, and I asked a question that has received thus far 29 people saying, here's the answer, and by the way, it was much too easy. You know, they always rub it in my face when they think it's too easy. And I guess it was. So I'm going to ask the question in a different way and make it a little harder and see if anybody can guess that. Now, of course, you know, you can cheat and go on the Critzer Lang column and see what the obvious hint was. But let's work on the honor system here and see if we can do something. Think of a very famous Walt Disney animated character and his very famous song that could actually be a way of telling us that he owns an original Broadway or London cast album that sports a Tony-winning score. That's all I'm going to say. Once again, a very famous Walt Disney animated character and his very famous song that could actually be his way of telling us that he owns an original Broadway or London cast album with a Tony-winning score.
All right, if you have an answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. And we'll let you know if you have gotten the slightly more complex question. Although I think I'm going to have to cheat because I don't even think I would even get it with the easier version.
I see.
My wife would. She's a big Disney-phile.
Ah.
All
yes,
right.
Right. That's right.
So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can still beat them by coming in last cause. The secret of happiness is I've discovered the secret of happiness is not to be afraid. I've discovered the secret of happiness is I